listeners. Welcome to the Tipsy Archives. This is your host, Rachel Liggy. In this episode, Aaron Redekop and myself talk about a fairly cringeworthy topic, art destruction and vandalism. Some of the incidents we talk about are accidental and even well-meaning, but most of them were done out of outright protest and anger. We also touch on the scientific field of art restoration and conservation. So we hope you guys find that interesting as well, because we thought it was fascinating. Also, for everyone who's listening and has stuck with us from the first few episodes, I know the sound hasn't always been great. We've definitely been learning as we went. We started off with a different microphone. I'm very pleased to say that we have both upgraded to much better quality microphones, so you shouldn't have to suffer through any more terrible audio. And if you did, thank you so much for listening and sticking with us. We really appreciate it. But yay, no more crappy microphones. Technology is awesome. So sit back, pour yourself a glass of wine, of course, unless you're driving or on public transportation, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Okay, Aaron, today we're going to talk about something that might make you really sad.
What are we going to talk about?
We're going to talk about art vandalism and art destruction.
Would anybody vandalize art?
That's a good question. Why would anybody vandalize art?
Well, I guess there's a lot of reasons people vandalize it by accident. There's stupid incidences that happen.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of accidental art destruction. You know, I think we've all seen news stories of people who trip and punch paintings.
Yep. And I think one of my favorite stories is there's the casino guy, Steve Wynn, and he suffers from an eye disorder, and he had a bunch of friends over to show them a Pablo Picasso piece that he was going to sell. And he fell, or he put his elbow through it because he didn't realize how close he was. And then they all drank a bottle of Bordeaux and swore they'd never tell anybody about it. And that lasted like a month.
And now the whole world knows.
And it went up in value because I think because of the incidents. Because he wound up actually selling it to the same person that he was originally going to sell it to for way more. But he would have also had to pay a lot of money to get it fixed because, like, fixing vandalized art or damaged art is not a cheap process.
Well, luckily he's a billionaire.
He is. I mean, he did be like, oh shit, but.
So, I mean, obviously, like, you know, that's a case of an accident happening.
Yeah.
But there have been many cases throughout history of people who have been intentionally vandalizing famous paintings. And usually these are people who are disenfranchised and pissed off, trying to make a statement. Or sometimes it's about, you know, they think somebody divine is talking to them, or they have some mental health issues, or, you know, whatever the case, they're trying to get some attention.
Yeah, there's normally a purpose for it, whether it's they think God is speaking to them. So there's a lot of reasons why people vandalize art, and a lot of it has to do with nationalism and taking back works of art that originally belonged to different countries, or people are angry about the fact that an art gallery has a piece of work. And a lot of that comes from the war, too, because a lot of things got stolen during World War II.
Yeah, and there's a lot of paintings, you know, in Europe that have been moved around. And speaking of a painting that was hidden and moved around a lot during war times, so we'll start with one that everybody knows. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't even need to describe what this painting looks like because everyone knows the Mona Lisa.
Everybody does know the Mona Lisa. And if you don't, well, you're living under a rock, and get to the internet right now and Google the Mona Lisa.
But don't throw that rock at the Mona Lisa because that has already happened.
Somebody did that. The Mona Lisa had a really bad year. I feel like 1956 was not a good year for the Mona Lisa.
No. I mean, and this was, so in 1956, a man threw sulfuric acid.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, he didn't have extremely good aim because he only managed to hit the bottom section of the painting.
Yeah.
And not too much of it was damaged.
Yeah, and it's like her elbow area.
Yeah, I think there's a tiny bit you can see now after it has been restored. And later that year, like we just said, a young man flung a rock at it and chipped some pigment off the lower corner.
Yep.
So after that happened, they, you know, decided, you know, at the Louvre that they needed to protect it, and they put up some bulletproof glass, which has been very good because it has been attacked multiple times since then.
Yeah. There's the Russian woman who was really distraught over being denied French citizenship, and so she went to the Louvre gift store, bought a mug, and threw it at the Mona Lisa.
I wonder if she went to the gift shop, like, if she had gone there. Like, she obviously came. I'm trying to imagine, like, the mental state or, like, the thought process going on here. Did she walk into the Louvre thinking, I'm going to do this thing? Or did she, was she having a nice time and bought a mug and then suddenly was overcome? You know, this is, what, 2009 or something. So yeah. She could have gotten a text or an email and found out and suddenly become enraged.
I'm more inclined to believe that because I've had those moments. Like, never where I'd throw a mug at a piece of art, but that's also because I really highly value art. But, you know, I've had those moments where I get filled with rage and I want to, like, throw my phone or something like that. And
there's always a ton of people standing around the Mona Lisa. So, like, I feel like you could have accidentally hit somebody pretty easily.
Yep. I mean, it's actually probably a good thing that she hit the bulletproof glass rather than somebody else.
In the 1970s, a woman also attempted to spray it with red paint, but of course it was protected by the glass, so it was perfectly fine.
Well, the Mona Lisa's had a really interesting history.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, like, it's been through a lot. It's been kidnapped and stolen and put in back closets and put in the washroom of a French king. And
yeah, like, it hung in Napoleon's bathroom.
Yeah, yeah. It's been cropped.
Yeah.
Somebody bought it and decided to put it in a smaller frame, so cut off some of the edges.
Yep.
Yeah, the Mona Lisa has been through a lot, and definitely that could be the topic of a two-hour, and I'm sure there are many, many documentaries out there that talk all about what she has been through.
Oh, exactly. Well, actually, my boss was talking to me about the Mona Lisa yesterday, and we were talking about how one of the reasons why she's actually so famous, I mean, part of it's the smile, but it became really, really famous when it was stolen. And people would line up to see the space where the Mona Lisa used to hang.
And this is in the very early 20th century, I believe. I think it's 1911.
Yes, it was. So it was August 21st, 1911. And there was a lot of theories about what had happened. They thought it might have been this poet who had talked about wanting to burn down the Louvre. They actually hauled Pablo Picasso in for questioning because he was good friends with the poet.
Right.
But it turned out it had been the janitor, and he'd hidden in a stairwell and snuck in and stolen the Mona Lisa.
And I watched a television show about this too, and I saw, we don't want to get too deep into this topic because it's not necessarily about her vandalism, but that he managed to kind of seize this opportunity to steal the painting and then took it home and basically freaked out because he was like, oh my God, what have I done? What am I going to do? Like, I can't sell this to anybody.
Yeah.
Like, everybody knows what this painting is. So, like, he sat on it for a while, just not really knowing what to do with it.
Yeah.
And then attempted to sell it back to the Uffizi in Florence.
Yeah.
Which, of course, right away, they're like, yes, this is Mona Lisa. You are under arrest.
How, like, even though, like, it's 1913 when he decides to do that. But how do you really think that a gallery, especially the Uffizi, is not going to recognize that this is the Mona Lisa?
Well, no, I think he wanted them to recognize it, but he thought that their, like, patriotism to the fact that this was an Italian painter and that he felt like he was returning it home, that they would be so grateful that they would look past the fact that it was stolen.
Right.
But then, like, legally, how could they hang it up when it is supposed to be in the Louvre?
Yeah.
But, I mean, like you said, that's a whole topic unto itself.
Well, and I mean, laws of possession were different at that time, but a piece like the Mona Lisa, I feel like you can't get away with that. I mean, before it had been stolen. Well, not necessarily stolen, but it had changed hands a lot. There's a lot of art that changed hands in the past, and not to sort of the same detriment that happens.
Well, why don't we move on from the Mona Lisa to talk about another lady?
Okay.
And this story, I think, is quite interesting because it features a very feisty suffragette.
Oh, I love our feisty suffragette.
Yeah, so in 1914, this woman, Mary Richardson, she goes to the National Gallery in London, somehow has a meat cleaver, hidden on her person somewhere.
Don't think you could be able to get into the National Gallery with a meat cleaver anymore.
No, not now, but at the time. And she attacks Diego Velázquez, Roque B. Venus. Mm-hmm. And this painting is a beautiful woman reclining on a couch. You know, there's an angelic little cherub above her. Mm-hmm. There's definitely an emphasis on the curve of her shape, and you kind of see her from behind, her nude body. Mary Richardson, she smashes through the protective glass and she chops her, you know, chops at the painting about 7 times, slashing at it.
Yeah.
And she, of course, was arrested. And, you know, she was very upset because one of her friends, also a suffragette, had been arrested, I think, you know, a day or two prior. And she was protesting this.
Yeah, it was the arrest of Emmeline Pankhurst. And she'd been arrested a couple of times for interactions with the police. And she was, or Mary Richardson was really not happy about that.
Yeah, so there's a quote here after her arrest that Richardson said, "I have tried to destroy the picture of the most beautiful women in mythological history as a protest against the government destroying Mrs. Pankhurst, who is the most beautiful character in modern history. Justice is an element of beauty as much as color and outline on canvas." But she also went on to say later on that she really just hated the way that men looked at the painting.
Yeah, she was like, the way that men visitors gaped at it all day long.
I mean, like, I can kind of understand, you know, a suffragette in that time. I mean, and even now, I mean, it's, you're fighting to be taken seriously in, you know, the female gender. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, being fed up with and sick of the idea of women being sexualized and stared at in that way.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe don't destroy art.
Yeah, I'd prefer it if people didn't destroy art to make those statements. The interesting thing also when you look at that piece is, like, it is a very sensual piece when you look at the curves, but it is from the back. And so there are way more graphic depictions of a naked female body in art. And I guess it is the sensual nature of that piece that sort of drove her to do it. But I find it very interesting that she picked that one rather than,
well, you think know, full it frontal. It was the archetype of Venus. Yeah. As the sexuality of women and the vulnerability and the, you know, just the idea of the mythological beauty that she was attacking.
Yeah.
And maybe that was just one that was accessible to her.
That makes sense. And I guess in 1906, there really wasn't the idea that women's sexuality can be power. Mm-hmm. And I can sort of see why she would get frustrated by just seeing male visitors gaping. And, like, this is before internet porn or anything like that. So you'd have it right in front of your face.
Yeah, ultimately the painting was fairly successfully restored, and it's, I think you can still see a little bit of the damage, but it's pretty hard to see.
Yeah, I mean, art restorers are really, really good at what they do. There's a huge amount of work that goes into restoring art, and I'm always so impressed at the work that gets done.
Yeah, I was telling you before I hit record that I watched a very interesting short little documentary about the restoration that happened when Mark Rothko's, I believe it's called Maroon on Black or Black on Maroon, was vandalized at the Tate Modern at some time, I think in the last 15 years, somebody came in and they tagged it with yellow spray paint in the lower corner. And the documentary talks about, or, like, I don't know if you can call it a documentary. It's probably only maybe 15 minutes or so, a little film clip. Mm-hmm. I'm sure if you Google Tate Modern and Rothko vandalism, it would come up. But they really go into the scientific process behind how they fix these paintings, because you're dealing with, I mean, like with Rothko, I mean, that's only from the 50s and 60s, but some of these paintings you're dealing with are 500 years old.
Yeah.
So they're dealing with these old pigments and these old varnishes that are so old, and they want to do as little damage as possible, removing new paint or removing marks. And so it's very, very scientific, and they have actual, you know, art scientists or, like, excuse me for not knowing the actual name of those positions.
Yeah.
But, like, people with lots of schooling and lots of scientific background who are on, you know, employed by these big famous galleries for these reasons to restore and fix up and preserve these pieces of artwork. And it can take, like, months, even years.
Oh, yeah. I believe it's The Last Supper. has been restored multiple times.
Oh, and it's probably at this point more restoration than original painting.
Which is a very interesting debate in and of itself, is how much work should be put into restoring a piece of art, or at some point do you actually just have to let it age and see the process of aging?
So that's such an interesting painting. I mean, that was one of the really early amazing examples of like linear perspective and correct perspective in Renaissance artwork. So like it's such a pivotally amazing piece of work in that time period. But you know why it's falling apart so badly?
No, I don't think I do.
And because Da Vinci was experimenting with different kinds of paint.
Yeah, the pigments.
As he did. He was like such an experimental artist or like person. And he was playing around with mixing oils with tempera paints and trying to like make new and like using oil on fresco. And like this was one of his experiments and it just did not work out very well. And so that's why the paint just keeps flaking off.
Right. I do remember studying that.
I mean, of course, it has been bombed.
Yes.
I mean, they did preserve a lot of it in the bombing, but the building around it came down.
Yeah.
And, of course, monks cut a door in the bottom of the painting.
I do remember that.
Yeah. So, like, if you look at it now or the mural, it's, you know, like the bottom of the table where their feet are, there's a door to the kitchen.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, like, it is a good question of, like, when does this stop becoming a Da Vinci mural and just becomes, I don't know, I guess a new incarnation.
Yeah.
Or it's just evolving and we're desperately grasping to hold on to keeping it in existence.
It kind of reminds me a bit of like a paint by numbers thing now where he's laid out all of the framework and we're just like painting within that to try to make it still resemble that piece.
I always want to buy those really crappy versions of it at dollar stores that are like holographic.
Oh, yeah. Well, I remember after I read The Da Vinci Code, I really wanted to just look at it. And a friend of mine, her parents had
We all read it and we were 20 and we're like, oh, my God, it's real.
It's so good. And then I reread it later and I was just like, it's like a Dick and Jane book. It's like, Robert is afraid of the elevator. Robert sat in the elevator and had a panic attack. Robert taught class. It's just not a good book. Not a good book.
We're just going to, like, trash Dan Brown podcast. It pulls you in, and it's very entertaining. But I remember first reading those books, and I was just like, I can't believe I never knew that this was real. But, like, now I'm like, no, it's just a really good fiction.
And you know what? The story is
good
really
fiction.
Good.
It's entertaining fiction.
It's really entertaining fiction. Yeah. Terrible prose, but great, great kind of fun story. And I really, really enjoyed reading it. I demolished it in about a day.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Well, it hit everything that I love. It was art, mystery, and then, you know, Tom Hanks in the movie. And I love Tom Hanks, so it all worked out.
That was our book minute on
on the Gypsy Archives.
The Gypsy Archives.
But it's not the recommended reading. It's the maybe watch the movie. I don't know. It wasn't really a good movie. But yeah, to go into a little bit more about restoration, I know we're talking more about vandalism, but there's a...
Yeah, but it absolutely, like, goes hand in hand.
It really does. Well, and this one doesn't go as much hand in hand, but...
But, like, watching that, while you look that up, I'll just say, watching that little clip about the Rothko restoration, I mean, like, they showed the people restoring it, and they're literally just sitting there, like, dabbing a Q-tip or, like, a paintbrush into a tiny bit of solvent and then just, like, dabbing it just, like, for a second, like, dapping it with a tiny piece of tissue and, like, and they'll, you know, restore a centimeter.
Yeah.
In a day.
And it's...
And I'm sure it's extremely tedious, but, like, I thought it was very interesting.
It would be crazy. Like, I've talked to conservators before, and it's a little... It's different than restoration because you're making sure that a work of art can be preserved and
or sometimes they probably have to strip off maybe a shitty varnish and apply something better or something like that.
It's just such a process, and I can't imagine doing that job either, because it's just so meticulous too. I mean, you probably have a little bit more of an insight into that, like being an artist yourself, but for me, I'm like dealing with that small amount of art. I wouldn't be able to handle it. Be so stressed out the entire time that I was going to fuck it up.
Well, and something that we were talking about also was was the idea of, like, how, you know, when these artists have created these pieces, like, how permanent did they think they were going to be? Does every artist think that their artwork is going to last forever?
Yeah.
Or is some artwork, I mean, you look at graffiti.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, that you spend a couple hours working on this, like, really cool image on the side of a train or a building. Mm-hmm. But you basically know somebody's going to come along and paint over it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that's a really interesting form of art that you know is impermanent.
Well, and Banksy is a really great mm-hmm. example of that, because he has some really neat works of art. I mean, now, because he's so famous, a lot of his works become permanent or semi-permanent.
Mm-hmm.
But, and also, is that vandalism? I mean, it's not art vandalism, but where does that fit into things, too?
I guess it depends who owns the building and how they feel.
Yeah. I mean, I think because of how famous he is now, if your building gets vandalized by Banksy,
mm-hmm.
then everybody's going to come see your building, and I would just try to capitalize on that. But so, yeah. I'm a marketer, so.
If at some point something becomes worth money, suddenly it's valuable and no longer vandalism and no longer a nuisance.
Exactly. And people seem to like that.
So, I know we weren't going to bring this one up because we didn't really have a lot of information on it, but because we're just talking about graffiti, I just think mm-hmm. it'd be really good to mention. I'm sure people heard about the case of the 80-year-old woman. I'm sure many people probably heard about this when it happened a few years ago, but it was the woman in her 80s who is living in Spain, and she decided to take it upon herself to retouch a very old mural of Jesus that was on the side of a church.
Yeah, she was really upset with the way it was deteriorating because of the moisture in the air.
Yeah, so, she thought that she would just try her hand at touching it up. And if anyone has seen, it's hard for us to convey, like, hopefully you've seen it, because obviously this is an audio recording, but it ended up looking like, you know, like a six-year-old child drawing, like, a monkey Jesus
yeah.
or something.
Or, you know, he kind of looks like he's wearing those, like, Russian toques and then has a neck beard.
Mm-hmm.
We'll post an image on Twitter if you want to take a look at our Twitter.
Apparently the mural was originally called, like, Ecce Homo, Behold the Man, and then the press dubbed it Ecce Mono, Behold the Monkey.
It is a hilarious image.
And it became kind of an internet sensation. And I mean, a lot of people were outraged that this woman would do this, but I think she very innocently was thinking, like, oh, I'm helping.
I'm helping. Nobody else is taking care of it. I'm going to take care of it. And I think it's one of those things, too. I don't know if you ever had that when you... Well, you're an artist, so you might not have had it. But me, having no artistic talent, I would try to draw something or paint something, and then I'd try to add to it because it looked terrible, and by adding to it, I thought it would get better, and you'd go on and on and on, and it would just look awful by the end.
100%. I'm sure that's happened to me many, many, many times, that I reach a point and I'm like, I'm loving this, and then I go a bit further, I'm like, I fucked it up.
What did I do?
Yeah.
It was really entertaining for me because I worked in an art gallery when this happened, because it was in 2012, and we would just send each other this image all the time. Whenever anybody would do something wrong at work or screw up at work, we'd just send this image to each other. It was quite hilarious talking to our gallery staff about it. They had a lot of opinions on it. Our curators were all very, very angry about it, and those of us that didn't work in curatorial found it a little bit more funny.
I think it's kind of hilarious.
I think it would...
I mean, like, it's a bit sad.
Had the image not turned out so funny,
yeah.
I think we'd be... Well, I mean, I personally would be a lot more angry. But now I'm just like, I kind of want to hug this image now and get a stuffed animal version of it. And
yeah, it looks a little bit adorable and, like, kind of fuzzy and weird and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think there are stuffed animal versions of it? I imagine.
I think that there are definite... I think it's become a little bit of a tourist attraction now. And I think I was just seeing that it is on, like, mugs and t-shirts. And they're like, well, we might as well make the best of it.
Well, if anybody wants to get me a Christmas present, you can get me a stuffed animal version of this and I will be very happy. So, I mean, this one was a very innocent tale of restoration. She didn't mean to do anything wrong, but there's a purposeful restoration that happened in Greece. It's Heinrich Schliemann, who's a well-known archaeologist, and he thought that he'd found Troy in Crete. And so he found an old palace there, and he decided to restore it. And so if you go visit Crete, you can see the ancient Crete used to have very vibrant colors and everything, but obviously over time that's all worn away. And so if you go to Greece now, most of the works don't have any color at all. But he decided to restore it to make it look like it would have in ancient Greece.
Do you mean like the statues?
The statues and the building. And so he painted like the wall murals and
the sides. Yeah, I've seen pictures and, you know, representations of what statues would have looked like in ancient Roman Greece. And they're just tacky as shit.
They're so tacky. And I feel like the beautiful, like, clear that we get now, it's...
But so you watch movies like Spartacus or whatever, and you see these, you know, they have as prop decoration these white marble statues.
Yeah.
That is not how they would have looked in that time.
Yeah.
They painted them to have, like, makeup, and they would put wigs on them and gold jewelry.
Yeah.
Like, they were just gaudy.
They really, really were.
It's like, basically, antiquity Versace happening.
Yeah. So they're not that simple pleasure that we see now. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I love ancient Greek statues. My husband and I are going to Berlin next month, and there's an incredible museum of classical works there, and I can't wait to go and see it. But the idea that he had painted it to make it look like the way it had looked in ancient times, I'm very divided on how I feel about it, because, like, as a historian, I think it's awful. Mm-hmm. I don't like the idea
of it. Just make a replica.
Yeah.
Like, don't paint the ruins.
Yeah. I feel like that's really highly problematic.
It's like, but did he need permission to do that?
I don't know exactly how it happened. I think at the time, I don't think there were regulations, because this is like the late 1800s, I think. So
speaking of, like, you know, your feelings on certain vandalisms, that wasn't a vandalism, but like what people have done to classical art or modern art. I don't know if you heard about this somewhat recently, the woman who was so moved that she kissed a Cy Twombly piece.
Yes, I remember hearing about that.
Now, if you're not familiar with Cy Twombly, a lot of his work is very, it looks like writing. It's very graphic. Like, he does a lot of images about, like, sort of like loose writing in lines and lines and lines over and over again. But yes, this woman was viewing his work, and she just felt so passionate about it that she laid a big kiss on it with red lipstick.
Yeah, and she got fined a lot of money for it.
Oh, yeah.
Well, actually, it's really not when you think about the damage that was done to it, because it's like, that painting is worth like 1.37 million euros, I think, and she got fined...
It's a couple million dollars, for sure.
Exactly, and she got fined, I think, 1,500 euros, so...
I understand feeling passionate about art, but, are you stupid?
I always want to touch art. Like, I always want to touch art, and I am somebody who works in museums and galleries, and I still want to do it. I don't do it.
But I think probably the difference, too, I don't have a piece pulled up, but knowing what I know of Cy Twombly and it being probably something on maybe like a paper-like surface, because a lot of his stuff, you know, was prints are done on paper. I'm just looking at this article to see if it says what the actual thing was. I think it's one thing if your fingers brush up against an oil painting that's varnished, you're not going to wreck it. But if you kiss something that's like writing.
Yeah.
In the oils from your lipstick and everything like that. Like, I don't even know if you can restore something like that.
I don't think you can. That does bring into an interesting thought. And I talked to somebody who worked at a gallery that I worked at, and they're like, it's so much easier when a work is vandalized or damaged if the artist is alive, obviously, because they can fix it.
Mm.
And then it's not restoring it, it's the artist doing something to it.
Yeah.
And so in, like, the Cy Twombly case, it could be like he would have been able to do it because he was still alive at the time, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think this is the early 2000s.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he was still alive.
I think he just passed away.
Yeah.
In the last year or so.
Yeah, so he would have been able to do something.
I think it was in the news a bit recently because they finally kind of were going through the court case.
Yeah, well, because she... That was the other interesting thing is she thought that the artist would understand and, like, be... I guess, moved by the fact that she was so touched by his work. It's bizarre. And, like, when you go into an art gallery, there's all of these signs everywhere. Mm-hmm. That's, like, the art gallery that I worked at had these little descriptions everywhere that was, like, don't touch the art. Even, like, the tiniest of oils on your finger can permanently damage a piece. Mm-hmm. And that's a big thing that gallery owners have to take into consideration when placing works, too.
I just kind of assume that most people know that.
Oh, I know. But people don't. And actually, I may have actually talked about it on this podcast.
One thing I do want, like, I want to touch is marble statues. But, like, I'm not going to wreck a marble statue. And I understand that, like, thousands of people touching a marble statue eventually will start to erode it.
Yeah.
But, like, just because of the nature of it being a 3D object and you know, the skill of them carving the muscle, like, that does make me want to touch it, but I don't. Yeah. But I want to.
Yeah.
There is actually, have you been to St. Peter's in Rome?
I have, yeah.
Do you know how there's that statue right in the middle? It actually might be of St. Peter. I don't know, there's, like, you're allowed to touch his foot.
Yes, yeah, and it's so worn.
And it's completely worn down. He's got, like, his one foot is still completely carved, and then the other foot is just completely smooth and worn away because thousands of people, millions and millions of people have been coming and touching the foot of the statue.
I touched it.
Since the 1600s or whenever it was put there. And so it does show you that, you know, enough wear and tear will, you know, wear that marble down. But I mean, that's hundreds of years and millions and millions and millions of hands.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I and really three-dimensional art, like when there was a, it was in that show at the art gallery that had the, I'm totally blanking out on all the painters.
Which day, when did you come see it? Was it the event that I invited you to?
19th century painters.
Was it the Matisse? No, not Matisse. Was it the
Cézanne? The Cézanne show?
Yeah.
And they had a really big mural of the other guy. I don't know what is wrong with my brain right now.
Was it Van Gogh?
It was a Van Gogh. So at the, I remember seeing that Van Gogh painting at the art gallery a couple years ago, and you could see how thick the paint was applied. And that does make you kind of want to get in there and inspect the thick oil paint on there. But unless I was 100% alone, like, and even then I'd probably, like, it would be the smallest, like, I would barely touch it.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, my brain definitely goes, no, don't touch that.
Well, I have a hilarious story about that, and I don't know if I talked about it on this podcast or a different thing that I was getting interviewed for, but a group of my friends and I went to an art gallery show out at UBC, and there was a work of art that was a pile of sand, and that piece had been on display at the Vancouver Art Gallery before, and when it was on display at the Vancouver Art Gallery, you weren't allowed to touch the sand, and there was a sign that said, do not touch.
Hmm.
When it was on display at UBC, the sign actually said, please touch, because part of it was you were supposed to play with the sand and create different objects out of the sand. But everybody who I was with is people who, you know, attend gallery openings a lot. We just automatically assumed that the sign said don't touch. And so we didn't even read the please touch. We read it as please don't touch. And so we just stood around, and everybody else at the opening also just stood around. And
so then nobody was touching it?
Nobody was touching it. And then all of a sudden my friend was like, wait, there's no don't in that. It says, please touch.
Yeah.
And then we read the description and it, you know, it said, please play with this piece. Mm-hmm. And then we started playing with it and everybody else started playing with it. But it's almost, to most, like, people who go to galleries on a regular basis, you automatically assume you can't touch anything. And so,
well, everybody really should assume.
You really should. But,
like, don't lean on the walls or anything.
I remember once I was at an art gallery opening with somebody, and there was a couch, and they thought that the couch was a piece of art, but they sat on it, and it was just like, no, you can't sit on the couch. Like, it says, please do not sit on this. What are you doing?
Well, a lot of museums that you'll go to, I mean, I say a lot of museums in Europe, or, you know, I was even say, like, going to a historical site like Craig Derrick Castle in Victoria, you know, the furniture is historic or replications of, you know, 19th century or early 20th century furniture or older. And they usually do a pretty good job of, like, draping a rope over it.
Yeah.
To indicate that you're not supposed to sit on it.
Yeah.
But when you've been walking around a museum or a gallery for an hour or two or three or four, like, yeah, it's just such a tease. And you just want to sit on that couch so bad.
I know.
But you can't. Usually they'll have a couple, like, crappy folding chairs in the corner so you can sit on those instead.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I always find that kind of funny about going in places like that where I'm like, oh, look at that nice sofa. No, I can't sit on it.
Well, and gallery floors are not good for your back. And so when you're walking around and standing on them, they can be so painful.
They should just start putting those rubber mats.
I really think that would be a good idea. Like, especially in front of, like, the Mona Lisa, given the crowds that stand up there to see it.
They don't want people to get too comfortable.
That's probably, well, especially in front of the Mona Lisa, people would stand there forever.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Paris for a week, and we were staying right by the Louvre, and so we'd go back to the Louvre almost every day because we had a week-long pass to it. And I still don't even really remember seeing the Mona Lisa because I'm short.
There's always just so many people.
There's so many people. I'm 5'3".
Mm-hmm.
I could never really get a view of it.
Yeah.
I don't remember really seeing it at all.
Being in the Sistine Chapel is a blur.
Oh, I loved the Sistine Chapel.
Yeah.
I
remember guards yelling at everyone.
Oh, you know, put your phones away! There's a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
I think my favorite part of the Vatican Museum is the Pantheon, the replication of the Pantheon.
I don't think we went in that room.
Oh, it is. It's my favorite room in all of the Vatican.
Erin, we're getting off topic.
Sorry. But that is a good indication of what you can do is build a replica. We talked about that earlier. Yes. Build a replica and put it in the Vatican.
Or in Canada.
Or in Canada so that we can see it. Let's build a replica of the Last Supper, like, on your wall or something.
So we were talking a little bit earlier about the idea of art and permanence and how long it lasts and what the artist expects. So I want to tell you about an art piece that I love and I think is extremely cheeky and hilarious. And so the abstract, well, Rauschenberg is kind of a post-abstract expressionist, and he makes a lot of statements with his art. And he knew William de Kooning, who is, I believe, also categorized as an abstract expressionist.
Yeah.
And so he asked William de Kooning to give him a drawing on a piece of paper, which he did, and it was a drawing that he had done in pencil. And so Rauschenberg took the drawing, erased the whole thing, put it in a frame, and then hung it up in a gallery and called it Erased de Kooning.
I really love that.
Yeah, and I think, like, I think that's really funny, and I think it's really cheeky, and it really brings up all kinds of ideas of, like, you know, art that was there and is now gone, and, like, something that you're never gonna see, and, like, how does the artist feel about that? Like, I think it just brings up so many questions.
Well, and especially in that incidents where he asked for the artist to give him a piece of work.
And I don't know, I don't think de Kooning knew that that's what he was going to do.
I mean, you kind of assume when you give something to Rauschenberg that
he's going to fuck with it in some way.
He's going to do something to it. Mm-hmm. But I don't think he would have expected that.
I mean, and you can still see on the paper, you know, there's definitely eraser marks. Like, you can, like, when you erase something, it's not a blank piece of paper, it's
yeah,
you know, really faint, kind of rubbed out, almost like a dirty-looking, smudgy piece of paper.
Yeah, and you can sort of see the faint outlines of what it used to be.
Yeah, so, I mean, like, that's a very conceptual piece. That's not what I would call vandalism, but I think it's very interesting when you talk about, you know, something you've created and then is gone, or it's been messed with in some way, and I think that when I learned about that piece in a drawing class, it definitely tickled me.
I really like that one. I mean, Rauschenberg is one of my favorite artists just because he has so many interesting things that he used to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I really like that story. And that actually, it just popped a thought into my mind of, and this is a very, like, hypothetical question. Well, not hypothetical, but it's very sort of thought-inducing question is it vandalism if you own the work?
Huh. Kind of.
Yeah.
I mean, you do own it, but I almost want to say maybe it depends on how important and famous the artist is.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense.
It's like if you, I mean, and we'll talk in a second about a Michelangelo piece, mm-hmm. but if you have a Michelangelo and you wreck it, mm-hmm. yes, people are going to be outraged. Why would you do that?
Mm-hmm.
If you buy something from an artist that you met at a gallery down the street, nobody knows who that is, you might piss off that person, but it's less of a big deal. Or is it the same?
Yeah.
It's, I mean, I can't, I don't think it is.
But I don't, well, and it's...
You could argue that it was.
Yeah, you could argue, and I mean, if you own a Michelangelo, you don't really own the Michelangelo. Like, you own it for the dollar value that is attached to it.
You are allowed to put it where you want, basically.
But I don't feel like...
don't screw with it.
No, because it's history, right?
Yeah.
That's a piece of history. But then is every piece of art technically a piece of history?
No.
I get into these very, like, deep, thoughtful questions.
When you get to these people that, you know, you call the masters, and they are from a time period that's hundreds of years ago, we can't get any more of those.
Yeah.
And I think that's the difference. Like, we can't make any more. And there's so few, say, like, finished Da Vinci paintings.
Yeah.
There's only a handful because he had a short attention span and finished things. So, like, to destroy something like that, I mean, that's a huge loss, I think.
Yeah.
But, you know, unfortunately, as much as we like to say every artist's piece of artwork is important, I mean, that's a little precious.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's probably more where that came from.
Well, and there's probably a lot of really, like, crappy Da Vinci pieces that we never saw.
I mean, there's tons of sketches.
Oh, yeah, he's got tons and tons of sketches.
I mean, I would still be pissed off if anybody erased one.
Can you imagine just erasing?
Erased Da Vinci?
Oops.
It's a little less cheeky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it definitely would not be as funny if it was a master's piece. But I think, I mean, when you ask the artist for a piece, but... I feel like I'd be really, I mean, I'm not an artist, but I'd be really pissed off if I gave a piece of work to somebody that I, because it depends on the piece, right?
Yeah, I don't think about if it was me. If somebody bought one of my paintings and then painted over it, yeah, that wouldn't make me feel very good.
Especially one that you've put a lot of time into, like if it was just like a quick
hours and hours and you're super proud of it.
If it was just, like, you know, a 15, 20-minute sketch, maybe not so
I would prefer they vandalize it in the name of, you know, God in a really dramatic way and it be in the news than them just be like, I painted over it because I thought it'd be funny.
Well, you'd get famous if they'd vandalized it in a really epic way.
Yeah, so, I mean, that leads us into one of the last, or the last major piece we'll talk about.
That's what I was about to
which
say.
Is, like, we started with Da Vinci. Everybody knows about the Mona Lisa. And then, you know, let's move on to Michelangelo, who, of course, is one of the other Ninja Turtles.
That was totally the joke I was going to make.
Me to it.
Great mind.
But yeah, so Michelangelo's Pietà, which is a statue in St. Peter's Basilica, which is the giant church in the Vatican. If you're not familiar with what it is, you probably have seen it. It is the statue of, you know, Mother Mary holding her son after he's been taken down from the cross. If you don't know who that is, it's Jesus. so sorry. Mary holding Jesus on her lap, and he's basically dead or dying.
Yeah.
And it's just, she has a very serene look on her face. And if you want to technically get into the proportions of the statue, they're actually very off.
Oh, they're so off.
She's like a giant mother woman holding her small man child son.
But I've heard that was actually partially on purpose because he wanted to show that he was her child.
Yeah. I mean, like, maybe. It was pretty early on in his career, too. So, I mean, it could have been that he hadn't mastered it yet. Or maybe it was intentional. Who knows?
Well, I mean, portions have always been a problem, especially in depictions of the Virgin Mary and Jesus. There's so many ones, like, when he's a baby that people have depicted where he's almost as big as her and he's just a baby.
Or I love the early... you know, some of the medieval, the sort of late medieval, early Renaissance pieces where baby Jesus is essentially just a tiny human.
Oh, yeah, it's great. And you're like, that's not how babies look.
I love those pieces.
Or the giant heads.
Yeah.
The giant heads.
There's so many weird and creepy baby Jesus pictures out there in the world.
I feel like we could do an entire podcast on weird baby Jesus
imagery.
It'd
be hard because we couldn't show people.
I know. If we ever do, like,
we'll
a live
lecture. We'll
just
put a gallery up on the Facebook page.
Yeah, and we'll be like, these are weird baby Jesus pictures.
Yeah.
But to go back to the Pietà.
So, I have met a few people who have told me that, you know, when they were teenagers, you know, older people, and they went to go see the Pietà, they could see it. Like, they could walk up to it. They could almost touch it because it wasn't behind bulletproof glass.
Yep.
Now it is behind bulletproof glass, and I have been there, and it's, you can definitely see it, but you can't get that close to it.
I was really disappointed when I saw it because for me, because I have a classical art background, I love sculptures and I love the way that you can create texture in a sculpture, and the way that her gown is depicted in that is just incredibly beautiful, and you can see all the folds. You can see the way that that gown would have moved if she'd moved. And
I'm assuming that you managed to go see all of the Berninis.
I did.
At the Borghese.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, the Borghese Villa. So those you can get right up close to. Oh,
you can get so close.
And see all the flesh and the hands. And, oh, I love this so much. Anyway, off topic.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so in 1972, unfortunately, a man named Laszlo Toth attacked the Pietà with a hammer. And he was yelling out, "I am Jesus Christ, risen from the dead." And he smashed Mary in the face, breaking off her nose.
Which has never been able to be reconstructed properly.
I mean, it is, and I think from the distance, maybe that's why they put it behind glass, so people can't get too close and see how.
Well, and it's also because so they took a piece out of her back to do it, and because now it's set where you can't really see it in the round very well anymore, because they don't want you to see her back.
So, I mean, this is another example of somebody who claimed to be on some kind of divine mission, and that I hadn't really, like, when I learned about it in class, I hadn't really heard too much about this, him thinking he was Jesus, as much as my teacher was talking about how it angered him and then it angered God that so many people were looking upon this statue and not taking, you know, the gravity of the love that Mary had for her son, and that they didn't deserve to see that beauty and that love.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I remember studying the piece, and the emotion that you can see in her face it's overwhelming, if you were...
Well, it's very tender.
Yeah, it's that loving moment.
So, I mean, obviously they arrested him. Well, the Vatican police, so the Swiss Guard, arrested him, and he was never formally charged, but he was considered to be dangerous and was put into a psychiatric institution for a couple of years.
Yeah, and deported.
And deported because he was from Australia.
Yeah.
He was a geologist from Australia.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, just kind of a really bizarre instance. I did come across an article earlier. I didn't have a chance to really kind of check it and double check it, but that because of the attack, this article is claiming, is when they did find the signature. And this is one of Michelangelo's, I think, maybe only signed, I'm making quotation marks, pieces of work, because he didn't really sign his work.
No, he didn't.
And this is one where he wrote an M on it. And they found it because they were doing the restorations and putting these pieces back together.
That's really interesting.
So if that's true... That's, you know, Laszlo Toth found, you know...
Found a signature.
They found something because of him.
Yeah.
Probably still not worth the smash in the face.
No, not the destruction. I mean, it was like her eyelids came off and...
Poor Mary.
Hadn't she been through enough?
But yeah, I mean, they restored it fairly well. It's, you know, there's certainly, I'm sure if you get up close, cracks and...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't think I was able to get that close.
No, I mean, I wasn't. I just had read that, you know, it's, the restoration is not perfect. And
yeah, I don't remember really being able to see any indication of the vandalism when I was there. I mean, by the time you, like, when you're touring art in Rome, by the time you get there, you've probably seen so much art, because I did it on the same day that I did the Vatican Museum. And so time, there's so much art, and I love art.
And St. Peter's is just overwhelming.
Oh,
it is. It's just, it's one of the hugest, most ornate, beautiful, crazy churches you'll ever see in your life.
It's incredible. And I
think it almost overwhelms the Pietà. Like, if it was in a museum on its own, I think it might be a little bit more, like, glorious.
Yeah, but it seems so small compared to, like, the grandiose nature of St. Peter's. And I mean, I'm huge into architecture because, well, and, like, old architecture. And so I was very interested in just the building itself. Mm-hmm. And like, I was raised Catholic. I'm not a practicing Catholic anymore, but I have a really interesting view and like sort of fascination with old Catholic churches because that. Mm-hmm. And so
churches in general, I am fascinated by. I mean, and how you can really see the progression of architecture through the ages through churches, because that's really where the most money and the most attention was going for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Oh, especially like when you look at France and like the evolution of the Gothic mm-hmm. church, it's fascinating.
Oh God, I want to go to France so bad.
It's incredible. When I went to France, my mom has an art history background, and she, for one of her theses, I don't know what it actually would be, but when she wrote her thesis, it was on the Rose Window in Notre Dame, and so she'd studied all of the different churches.
Was that window not destroyed during any of the wars, or is it, like, original? I feel like that church has undergone a lot of damage. Sure your mom could tell us.
I'm sure she could. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that church is also always under restoration. There's always one of the sides of it is always under restoration. But she took me on a tour of all of the Gothic, like the major Gothic cathedrals in France. Mm-hmm. And we did them in order.
And oh, so you started at Saint-Denis.
Yeah, we started at Saint-Denis. We finished at Reims, and it was...
That sounds amazing. I would absolutely love to do that.
It was incredible, and some of the feelings that you get when you walk in... Like, I'm not really a religious person, mm-hmm. but some of the feelings when you walk into those, you feel, like, the presence of something.
Oh, for sure.
Because it's just, like, the high ceilings.
I 100% had that when I was in San Miniato in Florence. Which is a very Romanesque, almost like Byzantine mosaic sort of stuff. But yeah, it just like, it was just beautiful.
It's incredible. It's overpowering.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, even though we're like a little bit off topic now talking about churches, I mean, I think it kind of brings us full circle about like the power of art and like what it means. I think when there's a piece of art that is meaningful to you or has such a big piece of history, what it does to us as individuals or as a society or somebody that works with it in a museum or a gallery to have somebody attack it, it feels very personal.
So personal. And like I've had that moment where like I've been so moved by mm-hmm. art, like never to the point of somebody wanting to like kiss it, mm-hmm. but been so moved by art. And if I saw something destroyed, like if I saw...
I mean, even what's happening now with like, I mean, and I don't even want to get into this, but you know, you see like in the Middle East, churches and temples being destroyed. I mean, that's just, it's just history that we're losing.
It's heartbreaking.
And it's, yeah, it's awful because like, who cares? I mean, I shouldn't get into personal feelings, but like, who cares if it's not your religion? Like Christianity is not my religion. I still think everything there is beautiful.
Yeah. And it was created by somebody who really believes in it. Mm-hmm. And we shouldn't judge other people's religions and values and the things that they create for that. You know, it seems wrong.
Yeah, definitely. But I mean, you know, and we've talked about some pieces where the restoration or the accidental damage is a little bit more humorous.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are, like we said, there's so many cases of accidental destruction, of mildly hilarious destruction and things that are easily restored to pieces that have been completely demolished and we're never going to see again or will never be the same.
No. There was a...
And as long as there's art, people are going to keep doing this.
Yeah, as long as there's art, as long as we are able to move around, accidents will happen. Yeah. People will have political motivations, religious motivations.
People are always going to be disgruntled, and they're always going to want to protest, and they may take it out on some of our favorite art pieces.
I'll be really, really sad about that.
Well, take it out on the ones that are less good.
Okay, I have a question for you before we end. Oh, no. Okay, what piece would you be most upset to see vandalized?
I thought you were
going to
ask me what piece would I like to be vandalized.
Oh, okay, we can do that too.
I don't even... What would I be upset about?
Most upset.
Well, I'm totally in love with Bernini.
Yeah.
So any of those, like, the Hades and Persephone or Apollo and Daphne ones, like, if those ever were broken, definitely, those to me are really moving.
Yeah.
Like, I have looked at pictures of those and been brought to tears.
Yeah.
Let alone seeing them in real life. And definitely, like you said, the Gothic cathedrals, and I know a lot of them have been damaged through, like, you know, bombings and World War II, and so that has happened, but, like, those are just such an amazing snapshot of medieval Europe, that if we lose those kinds of things, like, it's just, like, as somebody who studies history, like, I just think it's tragic. So, I mean, there's just so many.
There's so many pieces. Mm-hmm. I remember being so upset about the fact that in World War II, they were storing gunpowder in the Pantheon. Or not the Pantheon, the Parthenon.
Oh, yeah.
And it exploded, and it damaged one of the amazing Athena statues that they had in there. And I remember reading that and just being so upset about it.
Well, and one of the things that I learned about in art school that made me very sad was Botticelli, who, of course, we know in The Birth of Venus, and I've seen a couple of those. There aren't that many Botticellis around, because when the priest Savonarola was preaching in Florence about, you know, people and their excesses, and we need to stop sinning, and he convinced a lot of people to burn their fancy goods, and he convinced Botticelli to burn a bunch of his paintings because Botticelli jumped on the Savonarola bandwagon.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so he was sucked in, and that's the Bonfire of the Vanities.
Right.
That's what that was about, is Savonarola convincing people to burn their jewels and their goods and their fancy clothes and their paintings because he was telling everyone that excess was bad. So they burnt a lot of stuff at that point too. So, I mean, there's all these Botticellis that we never saw because he was like, I need to be a better Christian. And
that makes me so sad because Birth of Venus is one of my favorite works.
At least it's still around.
I'm so glad that it didn't get burned.
So, like, before we, like, fall into a pit of despair.
Well, and I feel like we could talk forever right now.
Yeah, like, I mean, you know, try not to think too hard about all the art that isn't out there.
And think about the art that is still there.
The art that is still out there. And luckily we have, you know, like, so many people who work in museums and galleries that are preserving and are restoring, and you know, security guards that are protecting artwork from crazy people.
Security guards do a lot of work. And it's got to be so boring just standing there.
Yeah, 90% boring, occasionally really exciting, but probably 98% boring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so thank you for protecting our art.
Yeah, totally. So, and I think you already said the stuff that you, I think we shouldn't probably talk about what we wish it could get right. Even if we don't like it, it still has a right to exist.
It does. And to be fair, I mean, the monkey Jesus, I'm actually kind of happy that it happened because it didn't really look very good before.
No, it was falling apart.
It was falling apart. And I really like monkey Jesus, and I'm probably going to get a lot of hate mail now.
Send us any mail. We'd love to hear from you.
Even if it's hate mail, send it our way.
Okay, well, thanks for coming on and talking about art destruction with me. As usual, when we talk about art, we kind of meandered all over the place, but I had a good time.
I had a good time. I'm looking forward to next time.
Okay. Cheers.
Cheers.
Well, that wraps up this episode. Thank you again for joining us. If you want to follow us on Twitter or tweet at us, we are at Tipsy Archives. And if you'd like to email us, we are thetipsyarchives@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.